Hello and welcome to Talk Dialogue to Me, produced by Simon Fraser University's Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue. On every episode, we will speak with dialogue practitioners about their inspiring work and find out more about all the incredible things dialogue can do. This is Talk Dialogue to Me.
Hello and welcome to the Talk Dialogue to Me podcast. This podcast is produced by Simon Fraser University's Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue, and it is hosted on the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. I'm your host, Shari Virgitanyada. Today I'm here with Laurie Anderson. Dr. Laurie Anderson is the Executive Director of Simon Fraser University's Vancouver campus. Laurie is also an adjunct professor in the Faculty of Education, previously the interim executive director at SFU's Center for Dialogue, and the co-developer of SFU's popular Masters in Contemplative Inquiry and Approaches to Education. Before coming to SFU, Laurie spent 30 years in the public education system as a teacher, principal, director of curriculum, associate superintendent, and interim superintendent of schools for the Vancouver Board of Education. Laurie is a three-time alumnus of SFU, completing his B.Ed., M.A., and Ph.D. at the university. Laurie is here to share some of the insights he has collected over his life, career, and time as the interim executive director at the Center for Dialogue and the current executive director of the SFU Vancouver campus. Welcome, Laurie.
Thank you, Shari.
I have a couple of questions for you on this topic of leadership and dialogue. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey and pathway through dialogue?
Yes. Well, prior to coming to the Center for Dialogue, a lot of my involvement had really two types. One was working at the university and getting more familiar with the Center for Dialogue in my normal role. So I became familiar with how SFU thinks of the Center for Dialogue, rather specifically, thinks about dialogue, and got more and more exposed to that. Took part in quite a number of sessions, and also use the dialogic process that the university uses in some of the work I do. So that's the first, not it's the latest in terms of history, but the first one was we've, in my own work as a leader in various contexts and as a workshop facilitator, I've used dialogue, perhaps not as cleanly and purely as the Center for Dialogue might think about it, but it's always been an element within even conventional teaching, but also when working with people on trying to bridge across differences on topical issues and so on.
With your past year or so as interim executive director at the center, what are some of the experiences with dialogue that really resonated with you?
A lot of the times I met with people at the Center for Dialogue, they expected that the dialogic process would be used a lot in most of the issues and things that we dealt with. So I had to be aware of and ready for that as we were going through them. So there was a greater emphasis on using dialogue in a lot of decision-making, for example. Mm-hmm. And also when we were just having general discussions about things with a particular endpoint, when we're discussing issues, there was more attempts to follow some more the principles of dialogue, if you like, taking turns to speak, staying on topic, respecting alternative points of view without feeling the need to answer back or defend and so on. So it's not different from what I did before, but it was more, I had to be conscious of it. It's a bigger part of everyday life in the Center for Dialogue, using dialogue not just for the semester in Dialogue, not just in workshops and services we provide, but in the day-to-day interactions of people. So I quickly had to adjust.
That's really interesting to think of the adjustment that you had to make. Can you give some examples how differently you operated prior to taking on the role as interim executive director of the Center for Dialogue?
Well, a lot of the work that we do normally, we were in the conventional role for me as the quote-unquote the leader of the sessions. So there would be more facilitating for me in moving things ahead, perhaps more quickly, and not going as deep as we often do at the Center for Dialogue. So one was to slow down. That's one of the adjustments I made. Mm-hmm. Two was to think less about myself and getting something done as in terms of my agenda. And three was to really pay attention to, and this is not just about dialogue, but the what, and this gets to one of my ideas about leadership, is what's really going on in a room? Like, what is the dynamics that may not have been spoken? And how may you bring as much of that out and made it overt and heard so you can discuss it?
Mm-hmm.
One of the principles of leadership that I learned over the years is, it's put into short sentence, what it's about is not what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
So often in meetings, particularly when there's a strong emotional currency to the meeting, mm-hmm. there's something underneath the surface that for one reason or another, that's really the issue. So the issue is being talked about, but the real issue is some underlying need that's not being met
mm-hmm.
for fairness, for representation, to be heard, to be validated. At the center, I find people seem to be acutely aware of that, and they try to get at that. And so during my time there, it was something I did before as well. I'm almost trying to figure out, is what we're talking about really what's going on?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not in routine or small operational thing, but anytime there's a major issue being discussed. In my experience, typically there are needs below the surface, so to speak, that dialogue can help surface.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I should say that I was purposely trying to take a very soft approach, because knowing a light, soft approach, because I wasn't going to be there that long, mm-hmm. and it made it appropriate for me to put any kind of stamp on it about that. So I was aware of that, which was in some way a bit of a limitation, but probably a very good thing for the center.
As the current executive director of the SFU Vancouver campus, how does dialogue connect with the work that you currently do?
Not as much as it should. So we can also, I find we can get quite expedient, because all these balls are juggling in the air, and you meet with people, say the chair of a faculty unit or a dean or a group of people from Burnaby who are down for some issue or another. And often it's quite driven by towards resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And to the point I was making earlier, sometimes that drive to resolution passes over something that really needs to be looked at. And it's never really dealt with, as we say, it's buried but not dead, and it resurfaces again later. So I would say a bit more of a focus on instrumentalism and expediency, getting things done operationally, rather than spending or taking the time to go deeper and simply, as we do in the contemplative education program, simply to listen to where people are at. Maybe not about the issue per se, but get a sense of what's going on for people around the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And that can often be a very illuminating process to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something that we focus on a lot in the semester and dialogue program.
Yeah.
You know, shifting from a transactional relationship to a more relational relationship.
Yes. Yeah.
You are committed to resolving or discovering something of mutual interest.
Yes, yeah. Great. I didn't, in my own job, I don't do enough of that.
So I think it's safe to say that you appreciated your experience as interim executive director of the Center for Dialogue for what it brought for you
yes.
in terms of that shift in thinking about how one might lead.
Right. Yes. I was A, very privileged I was asked to do it. B, surprised I was there that long, because we
all thought. How long was it?
17 months.
Right.
And everyone thought it would be several months. So being around people who are engaged deeply, who the nature of their work is all using, I think it dialogues both a means and an ends together. So being around people who live that way and work that way, it was very good for me, actually. It was almost like a great refresher.
It sounds like your master's program in contemplative inquiry has quite a similar nature or approach.
Right. So we turn conventional teaching or pedagogy, as you got to say, on its head. And we try to, there's different words to describe it. One of them is to be relational in what you're doing, being holistic, looking after the part of what we think in the course program is, if you're not at least acknowledging or validating people's states in the learning process, if you're just concerned about what's happening cognitively, what they're taking in intellectually, and not paying attention or validating people's emotional, psychological, and even embodied physical state. Mm-hmm. These are all hugely important in learning. And in most classrooms, we usually don't pay attention to them. Yet they're hugely important in how much people can concentrate, how much they can learn, how they feel about being in the classroom. So yes, we try to pay attention to all of these things.
Mm-hmm. What do you think dialogue uniquely brings to leadership?
Mark Winston has a wonderful phrase, which I think is attributed to Mark, that the dialogue center creates space for difficult conversations. And I think if you can slow things down, listen to people more deeply, then there's an opportunity to have a more meaningful discussion or process where people feel they really have been part of something significant and they've been listened to and they've been heard. And we don't often do that. And I think that's the gift of dialogue in that sense. Even when people have profoundly different views on things, when you have an opportunity to create the conditions where everybody feels accepted, welcomed, and listened to, and understood, we used to say in the course that I taught that we have a need that transcends whatever our identity is, political, sexual orientation, socioeconomic status, all that. And that need is to be understood. And I would add to that, to be included and to be part of it. And dialogue has the capacity to do that.
That's wonderful. So, Lori, how has the practice of dialogue, the way you've just described it, how has that shaped the way that you lead?
A couple of ways off the top. One of them is that when I'm at a meeting, either the chairing it or just simply at a meeting, is trying to ensure everybody is included and paying attention to people who are not being involved in some way and trying to figure out, is there anything going on or not? Maybe they're not. Maybe it's just a day when they don't want to say, but paying more attention to that and rather than focus entirely on a tendency in a job like mine as an administrator is to focus on the meet and get through. Do we have to do it? And I think we're doing that, as I've learned sometimes through some interesting consequences, that you need to pay attention to what's going on for people and not just, the issue isn't always the issue. There may be something else. That would be one. And the other one that the Dialogue Center pays attention to a lot, and I would say there has to be a caution around, you can actually overdo this, where you're constantly asking people for more input all the time. I think we just need that to avoid. And I think that's something is affected by leadership, is asking for more input for people.
That's something that
I need to do more of it. The center of dialogue, as I was saying, I think when you do that work all the time, there can be times when that's done more than it has to be in order to get the desired result. Not everything has to be dialogued. For example, there's sometimes when the old traditional, conventional, the zero-sum game of debate even is appropriate.
And it's a different mode of communication. It's not a dialogue. Then.
Right. Yes, totally. It's not. It's sometimes in certain contexts.
Absolutely.
Particularly if people know that you're still included. And leadership tip number 57, whatever you're doing, you should always, regardless of the issue, you should always maintain the relationship with the person and separate it from the issue. So we used to say separate the people from the problem. And you really need to do that. So that's why sometimes debate is appropriate. But after you have the debate, you shake hands and that kind of thing. So, but for me, creating space to have these conversations and to make sure I listen carefully is what I learned from the Dialogue Center.
What are some tips or actions that you would encourage a leader to do to foster a stronger culture and dialogue in the workplace, recognizing that there is merit to dialogue?
Right. Well, I think going back to Mark Winston's notion of creating the conditions, I think a big role for a leader is to seed the ground, so to speak, to create the conditions for things to happen, for people to flourish, for example, for people to feel good about being there. Specifically about dialogue, I think that it's really important to give people a chance to get familiar with it so they can practice it. Mm-hmm. And even I would be explicit about what you're doing so that people know that one of your values is creating space for people to talk about difficult things. I think one of the reasons people don't engage in dialogic processes, they're just not sure how to get into it. They have never been taught the skills, get some of the ground rules about how you do these things. So I think the more you can do that bit, sort of model it and teach it at the same time, I think that's really important.
Mm.
For example, if I might, we just had a big meeting today that I left today with staff about a really important issue.
Yeah.
And it was quite vexing for a couple of people. And now the group that I work with is sufficiently familiar with what's going on and how we try to do things that rushing ahead and not papering over it is not a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So we took time to stop and ask people what's going on for you, is what can we do? What do you need right now? Which is one of the questions I like to ask. So I think that's one of the things I've learned from the use of dialogue. And I would have to say, and I think I said this, that yeah, it's a tendency I always have to get on with it and get things done. And I think as a leader, you need to be really careful not to succumb to this pure goal attainment thing where you've got to get the job done and move on to the next job. Because along the way, you may have missed a gem, or you may have not dealt with some of the issues around people's position on issues or their underlying interests.
Just speaking of the meeting that you just attended today, and you had mentioned that something had vexed some of the members. Can you elaborate a little bit more? Can you illustrate a little bit for us? What is that sort of a issue?
Yeah. And I do think a big part of leadership is trying to constantly monitor your own self-talk and what's going on for you and the situation. So I wasn't paying sufficient attention to that until I began to notice that these two people weren't moving with us. Uh-huh. And then that's when I noticed that we sort of slowed it down and then had a general discussion. And I can't remember how we started, but I know I said something about, I think we should slow down a bit and talk a bit more about some of the questions you might have or any needs anyone has here that we haven't covered. We've got lots of time, there's no rush, so let's just do that. Have another chocolate and take it with it. So we had to sort of almost humanize it in a way that I wasn't paying enough attention to.
But you were able to turn it around and
recognize
it at the right moment.
Yeah.
Provide some time and space for more dialogue.
Indeed, yes.
Mm-hmm. So Lori, this has been really interesting. I'm just curious now, what is next for Lori? Do you have any exciting personal projects or milestones that you'd like to share?
Well, the being back at the Center for Dialogue was really, although it was taxing, and I don't think I did justice to either the Center for Dialogue or my own job, but at the same time, it was really illuminating for me, and it came at the right time. I'm obviously near the end of my career, but I'm still wanting to, I still get jazzed about going to work. I still get really interested in the work I do. So I think it was a bit of a shot of energy for me to work at the Center for Dialogue. It really was. And there were some challenges for me because I didn't know everybody.
Yeah.
And people were looking, seeing me in a different way. So it was a good challenge for me to have that opportunity. So that's a prelude to answering your question.
All right.
Setting the stage for my answer.
Uh-huh.
Is that I want to try and use some of the things I picked up talking to people in Center for Dialogue in different situations in my own job. Maybe I do need to do more, but I do think I try to focus on the relational dimension of work a lot, and I need to perhaps even continue to do that and get this right mix. One of the big things I'm really interested in is, there used to be a thing about, and as a leader, you need to cultivate relationships and get tasks done.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, if you just do the tasks, and the relationships could suffer, and vice versa. If you're just having lovely relationships, you may not be getting the work done. So I used to see it as a relationship task continuum or two grids in X and Y axis. But if don't do that anymore, I think relationships are, so instead of seeing it as an X and a Y, I see it as relationships as the ground. It's the foundation.
Yeah.
It's what we stand on. And then you do the tasks. So that's changed for me, and I want to keep working on that. And both in my own family life with my children, my grandkids, and other people. And in my personal life, I want to do all of that more. So that's one of the things that I'm going to continue to do. And I think I'm also trying, as I get older, relaxing a little more about outcomes and being willing to be a bit bolder in decision-making than I have been in the past. I'm finding, and without trying, I'm finding I'm people have come to me and said, is this really what you want to do? And I said, yeah, that's what I'd like to do. Okay.
And what is that?
Being a bit more decisive. Yes. And also take more bolder action and be less concerned about what somebody may think about it.
I'm just noticing that people out there might think, oh, dialogue and decisiveness, are these opposites? How do you fit decisiveness into dialogue, I guess? And I'm just saying that because I'm thinking about our topic today, which has to do with why dialogue matters in leadership.
Right.
Right.
I do think that both in teaching, because we're in a university, I want to mention that, and in the way we go about our work, mm-hmm. whatever your work is, we should try and create the space to provide more dialogue. And in so doing, that, in my view, would lead to more enlightened, more thoughtful decisions.
Decision making.
Mm-hmm. So that's one misdifference. The other one, though, and this is a pet peeve of mine with Center for Dialogue, don't take this personally, Fox, is that, and I know everybody's talked about this for a long time, I did the facilitated the annual planning for the Center for Dialogue for years before I did this job. And one of the questions was always brought up, and we never entirely articulated or confirmed, was what do we mean by dialogue at the Center for Dialogue? And how would we recognize it if we're doing it? And are we all on the same page vis-a-vis what it is, when, and how to apply it?
Hmm.
Yeah, I think you'd still find that there's some dissonance or discrepancy about these things.
Hmm.
It's partly a pardon expression. It's an ongoing dialogue to discuss that.
Right.
But I do think the people outside the world of it, whatever, not really interested in the name, the dialogue, or whatever we choose to call it. They're interested in processes that give them a chance to be heard, to be included, and to have substantive, engaging, inclusive conversations. Whatever you call it.
Right.
And I think we need to be, I would focus more on what we're trying to do, what the benefits are, and get clear about dialogue. Because sometimes we can be shrouded in this kind of, it's a certain mystique that we do at the center and no one else in the world really understands it. I don't think a lot of people think that way now at the center. And I don't think that's a particularly healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, I think it's almost exclusive to be our little thing and we talk, only we do dialogue. Mm-hmm. I think we need to be careful about that.
That's really interesting. That's something that comes to mind then is something that you said earlier, which was having difficult conversations is under the surface, is kept under the surface because we want to be moving forward. And
or to be late.
Yes.
Or having
the transactions happen.
Yeah, or getting on with things.
Yes, getting on with things.
Yeah.
However, there's something under the surface.
It can be often. Yeah.
And how to get under the surface, how to really let people be heard and be seen and feel included and feel that sense of belonging. What is that made of? You know, where do you derive that peace? Really, it's a peaceful feeling to feel that you've got someone who's listening to you.
It's a beautiful thing, yeah.
Or who understands you, like you said, that is an ultimate goal. So dialogue, that art of dialogue, which is not an occult thing, shouldn't be. That's what our center is probably wanting
to do. Well said. That's terrific. That's exactly what I think. And I think that's what the purpose of the center is.
Mm-hmm.
In a very simplistic way, it used to be the iceberg idea, the metaphor of the iceberg.
Yeah.
People come into your room, I want this, I think somebody else, and we both picture and defend our positions.
Yeah.
But dialogue allows you to lower the level of the water and bring the iceberg up, and so that you can see what's really going on for somebody. Are they hurt? Or have they been denied justice in the past? Is there a long history of exclusion, persecution, or whatever? And dialogue can create the conditions where that can be raised without and still keep the other party engaged.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beauty. I've seen some of the people at the center, Aftab, I've seen do this, mm-hmm. and Mark Winston and many others who are so profoundly sophisticated in doing this. It's really a way to reduce polarization, and not even between tribes and groups, but between people in a classroom. Because I think once there's just a magic alchemy that takes place once people feel, yeah, she's listening to me. Yeah, my views matter here.
Mm-hmm.
I may not agree with this person, but he and she or he has space, and I've got space.
Right.
This is good. I would have missed something that could happen.
Absolutely. That is wonderful. I'm glad that we are seeing it in a similar way. And those are excellent examples. I remember Asad sharing that iceberg model in that same sort of way. So it's good that we have this shared language and shared experience. And that is probably something that we derived from our access to the Center for Dialogue.
Indeed. Indeed.
Now, I was just thinking of, the diversity that we have in our community at the center. And I'm thinking, folks who work with you, how would they benefit from access to the Center for Dialogue?
Yes, I think the more people are exposed to what the center is all about, what it does. I thought I knew what was going on because, as I said, I've facilitated a planning session for years. But it wasn't until I actually worked up there, saw the range of things going on. And I think most people are saying, just don't know. There is a bit of a black box thing, what goes on inside that place. So I think professional development would be useful, a training session, an opportunity for people like who can communicate so beautifully. Like I have time just to talk about what it is in a session or to model it too. We try to model it as much as possible, the things we do. But I think outreach by the center to engage with more groups in the university. And that's where I think, by the way, the Semester of Dialogue's future lies, is connecting with other faculties or other programs. Mm-hmm. I find it truly ironic and sad at a time when arguably we need dialogue more and more, we're not preventing students, as many students as they should, with the skills and the disposition to practice dialogue.
Mm-hmm. How do you see leadership changing, particularly after having served in a executive directorship role at a center for dialogue?
So I'm really fortunate to have an opportunity to do leadership symposiums with different groups. And I'm trying to, but the last few years I've been trying to figure out, I work with a group of educators. Every year a different group come forward to look at the current state and the future of leadership. And I have a couple of questions myself that I haven't read, is how fundamentally different are things? And do leadership principles still apply? And do we have to add new ones or change things? So these are sort of open-ended rhetorical questions. But I do think it is changing for a number of reasons. I can't go through all the factors, but one of them is some of the questions around the nature of leadership, because it's often seen as has specific characteristics. It's male-dominated. Primarily, mm-hmm. It often appears to be power over rather than power with, and it's often about about goal attainment, mm-hmm. task related, and these things. Well, I think a lot of people now are wondering how do we deal with that if we are going to move forward on questions of equity, of inclusion, and making sure everybody has a seat at the table. What are the implications for leadership for that? So that's a question I don't have the answer to, because there's two ways of looking at that. One is you simply provide more jobs for groups that have historically haven't had an opportunity to be in leadership.
Yeah.
That's one thing, which may be part of the answer. And the other one is, yes, that's fine, but we're not really changing the model. If the model's still power over, it doesn't matter if it's an old white male doing it or if it's somebody who's having the first fresh opportunity.
Yeah.
So we need to look at the model. And the other one, it was a lot of talk about distributed leadership for a long time.
Yeah.
Everybody should have an opportunity. But ultimately, I think there's a very little chance we're going to move to in institutions like ours into situations where we don't have even a relatively flat, but we still have a hierarchy, and we're still going to need people who make decisions, who have responsibility and authority to do that. So in that sense, leadership is going to stay around. But I do think we need to make it more participatory.
Right.
And find a way to do that, more time to do that, so that we have a bit of a problem now. We think that people feel in society generally that there, and I think that speaks, you can see this in the changing, the cynicism and distrust and apathy among people about voting and so on, and about politicians in general. There's been a big increase in that. So I think we need to figure out, how do we get people involved? How can we use leadership to get people more involved in all of the public processes?
Mm-hmm.
And dialogue, obviously, is part of the answer for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're always going to have, so short answer or summarize, we're always going to have conventional leadership, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
But how it's done and who's doing it is going to change over time.
If I can ask you to think back to your earlier days, did you have a mentor or a model, a leader who you aspired to being? What were some of the characteristics that you saw in that person?
One of the things that I learned more from people who were doing the job badly than who were doing it, and I'm not sure, that's modeling, but not the one I think you referred to. So I think an awful lot of leaders would probably say that what I've just said, when watching somebody who's incompetent is incredibly instructive.
And painful.
Yes. Yeah. So I learned a lot that way, but also more positively. There's always been people who did two things. One, did their own job in such an incredibly compelling, inspiring way, and they were so principle-driven, it touched you in every way. And then secondly, somebody who believed in me. I've always had somebody since the very beginning, when I changed careers and moved into education, who always thought, saw in me something that I wasn't entirely clear about. And even when I messed up, were always there for me. And I think that's, I've been so privileged to have people in my corner like that all my life. And I try as best I can. I try to do that for everybody that comes in contact with me.
Mm-hmm. Lori, can you tell me a story? A story about a successful leadership moment in your life. What has made you proud of the work that you've done in the past?
Yes, there was, I'll give two quick ones that just keep me up at night, and so they still resonate with me. One was when I was in a senior position at the school board. Mm-hmm. I was the acting superintendent, and something happened that I had to make a decision about. And the right thing to do, the principal thing to do, was going to cause a lot of pushback from certain people.
Okay.
And the way I wanted people to see me was going to be changed, because I had to do it. So I had to really decide, do I minimize this or do I do the right thing and deal with it, driven by principle? And it was a shock to me because it was a really big thing at the time, with a public issue too. So it was very significant. And I had at least one long night of the soul. I knew right away, okay, this is what I need to do. This is the right thing to do. But then I spent a day or two trying to think through all the multiple ways out of it, what could go on. And I realized, no, you're trying to find, it's in some ways, sometimes the right principle thing is not complicated.
Yeah.
It just comes to you. It's visceral. You know it. So I remember I didn't go and talk to anybody. I realized that I didn't consult with anybody. I didn't want to. I wanted not to be influenced by other people. So that was one where it was done. And the response from some people who didn't hardly ever knew me was overwhelming in terms of people coming to me saying that that was when you made your mark. That's when you began to show you had a spine as well as a set of principles. And then the other one was years ago, I was put in a position of being the principal of the first school in my school district to fully integrate children with special needs.
Okay.
And I was young, full of myself, thought I had all the answers, and started making scheduling changes and all that kind of stuff. And it was all wrong. The parents were, I didn't build a relationship with the parents. I didn't build a relationship with all the teachers, particularly teachers who didn't know enough about it and just saw this as a very difficult thing to do. And it took a long time, over almost into the second year of the job, before I had to listen to everybody and figure out what to do. And I realized where we ended up was 100% different where I thought I should do in the beginning as this brash new principal. And had to be, and that meant long sessions talking to people, bringing really tear-filled meetings with parents and teachers about things of their child in the classroom, mm-hmm. and how parents think that the child is being treated and so on. It was a lot of that, a lot of evening meetings about that. I remember driving home lots of times in tears and being so incredibly tired and drawn out by it, because it was, I realized these parents were just going through so much that I just simply had not spent enough time thinking about.
Mm.
And likewise the teachers, because it was a lot to ask a teacher to take this on if they weren't used to it.
Yeah.
So these would be two times when One was a slow burn where I had to figure, I learned a lot from other people. And the other one is where I realized that there's sometimes when it's absolutely clear we have to make a strong principled decision, no matter what anybody else might think or the consequences.
So I am really grateful for the time that you've given here. We appreciate your time and your energy to answer all of our questions. And we are deeply appreciative of that. Thank you very much, Laurie.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Talk Dialogue to Me, produced by SFU's Morris J. Wask Center for Dialogue. You can find out more about us at sfu.ca/dialogue and follow our podcast for more inspiring conversations as we continue to explore all the incredible things dialogue can do.